Well, often in its history, there have been attempts to describe Australia as a workers' paradise. It's sometimes suggested that Australia is a less class-driven society than other countries, such as, you know, the mother country of Britain. Australian society is often presented as politically moderate and quite unrevolutionary. The political purpose of that sort of official history is to suggest that, you know, fundamental social upheaval and change is not even worth pining for in this country because, you know, Australian workers are by definition just so inherently happy to ever do anything radical. However, this vision of Australia is thoroughly contradicted by the long history of intense class struggle in this country. And this history of class struggle is particularly worth examining at the moment because we are living through a time of unnerving stability in Australian politics. In fact, if we took a snapshot of Australia in 2011, there is not a great deal to write home about if you're left wing, especially not if your home happens to be in Egypt. I don't imagine people writing home to their family in Arabic, dear mum and dad. I'm sure we're all very excited about the revolution in Egypt, but let me tell you about the New South Wales elections. Now, of course, there are some, important campaigns which are putting on pressure on the government from the left, such as, the Equal Marriage campaign, the Equal Pay campaign being run by the Australian Services Union, and so on. Nevertheless, we've got a terribly right-wing Labor government, which looks quite certain to be replaced by an appalling Liberal regime of Tony Abbott. You've got, union struggle at a low, the radical left isn't very big, and so on. And on the whole, over the last 30 years, the Australian working class and the left have hardly been on the ascendancy. Importantly, the union leadership in this country has largely failed to resist the ruling class offensive, which has seen a restructuring of the economy in favour of greater job flexibility, for the bosses, i.e. more casualisation, less job security, and so on. Now, I'm not going to deal with the question of whether, the working class still exists, whether it still has... the changes mean that it still has the power to change the world, because that would be stealing the thunder of my esteemed colleague Tom Bramble, who will be talking on that subject later in the conference. What I would say just briefly is, in spite of all of the setbacks, the working class in this country is still a potent political force. From 2004 to 2007, Australian politics was dominated by a very major and very obvious issue of class conflict, and that was work choices. You had repeated mass rallies in the hundreds of thousands nationally, which at their height were the biggest days of mass union action in Australia's long history of unionism, and these rallies really helped to galvanise mass public opposition to work choices. So if you don't think that Australia is a class society or that class doesn't matter, on the one hand you have the Business Council of Australia, this peak capitalist body, running ads in the newspapers suggesting the world's going to end if work choices is repealed, really going into bat for this anti-worker, anti-union legislation. The vast majority of us oppose these laws. You don't have to take my word for it. The then finance minister, cabinet minister in the Howard government, Nick Minchin, was caught out on tape at a right-wing Sydney think tank, and he said, and I quote, "An overwhelming majority of Australians violently disagree with everything we have done on industrial relations." And the 2007 election result bears that out. Nevertheless, the Australian working class today is hardly engaged in some life-and-death battle against capitalism. And, obviously things are pretty quiet here compared to international events. So obviously the social conditions are different in Australia than a country like Tunisia or Egypt, but also Australia has not suffered from the global economic crisis to at all the same degree as has been the case in much of the rest of the Western world. And that would be obvious, of course, if you were at the sessions last night, heard from some of our international speakers about the radicalisation, some of the mass struggle going on in Europe and North America. All right. Suffice it to say, I'm not arguing in this talk that Australia is in some immediately pre-revolutionary situation or anything like it. But two things are guaranteed under capitalism. One of them is that there will be potentially quite long periods of stability in which the exploitation of the working class happens with only small or sporadic episodes of resistance. The other thing that's guaranteed under capitalism is that that situation will eventually end and militant class struggle will revive. And we should remember just how beaten back and dejected and broken up and repressed and demoralised the left, you know, the workers' movement, and the whole opposition was in Egypt in the 1990s. You know, Mubarak seemed thoroughly, thoroughly dominant. So the quiet is never permanent. And Australia is no exception to this pattern. It has been shaped, shaken rather, by periods of mass struggle, sometimes raising the prospect of revolution. And we could begin this narrative really at any stage, the great strikes of the 1890s. We could begin earlier with the Eureka Stockade, but I wanted to focus particularly on the 20th century. And I wanted to start actually during World War I and look at the period from 1916 to 1919. This is a very bitter period of class struggle. There were two attempts to introduce military conscription by referendum, which was both times was defeated by a mass campaign led by the unions. Revolutionary groups grew in this period, including the Industrial Workers of the World. In 1917, there was a general strike on across the eastern states of Australia, and major industrial battles reached their all-time peak in 1919. And what's interesting to note about this period, actually along with all the others that I'll look at, is how closely the peaks in radicalism in Australia match those internationally. Got to remember the period that we're going to look at now, the same years that saw the abortive Easter uprising in Ireland, the Russian Revolution of 1917, the Hungarian Soviet Republic being declared, the German Revolution, which overthrew the Kaiser and ended World War I, growth of mass syndicalist organisations, etc., etc. Marxists are internationalists. We recognise that capitalism is a global system and its crises, therefore, tend to be global as well. Resistance, therefore, must and usually is an international affair. And we only need to think of what's happened this year. You know, we have a revolution emerge in Tunisia, which very quickly spreads to Egypt and is now engulfing most of the Middle East and North Africa. In the years that I'm going to examine now, radicalism in Australia was underpinned by the effects of World War I, an international event, if ever there was one. Wartime Prime Minister Billy Hughes had gloated that war was like the glorious beams of sun that had dried up the mists of suspicion with which class regarded class. So expected that war was going to, just alleviate all of the kind of class antagonisms of society. Now, it's true that initially in 1914, there was somewhat of a, wave of patriotism, which saw, a decline, in industrial activity, a period of industrial peace, but a very short-lived one. By 1915, you have a major industrial dispute in the mining town of Broken Hill. And throughout 1916 and 17, there was a growing strike wave. And this was a result, actually, of the effects of war, the privations caused by war. In particular, there was massive, massive inflation, which really, degraded the value of workers' wages. So before long, war was having the opposite effect to the one that Hughes had predicted. You know, the class antagonisms were not being negated; they were being greatly amplified. Respectable society was very much for the war. You know, the Protestant pulpit, the newspaper editors, middle class and ruling class organisations were all whipped up into this patriotic frenzy. They were not the ones making the sacrifices. It was workers being made to sacrifice in unprecedented numbers, in which tens of thousands of young lives were being lost, in Gallipoli and on the Eastern Front. And of course, the sacrifices people being asked to make at home. The rich, of course, were continuing to prosper. There was wartime profiteering and so on. And all of this, the war and the question of conscription in particular, led to a massive radicalisation amongst Australian workers. We are told to think of World War I in this country in terms of the Anzac spirit, our nationhood being born on the shores of Gallipoli. But what rubbish. Like, the idea that Australia was brought together, our nationhood was brought together during World War I, couldn't be further from the truth. Actually, Australian society very nearly tore itself apart along class lines. Take the issue of conscription. The mood in the entire labour movement was so hostile to conscription that the union leaders in the rank and file drove from the Labour Party all of the MPs who supported conscription, including the then Labour Prime Minister, Billy Hughes. In July, the militant socialists at Broken Hill, a centre of working class radicalism, set up the Labour Volunteer Army. It attracted 2,000 enlistees. These were men eligible to serve in the military. And LVA members took the following oath. I, being fully convinced that the conscription of life or labour in Australia will be a death blow to organised labour, and I will resist, and will, sorry, will, and will result in the workers of this land being crushed into subjection by a capitalist military oligarchy, do hereby pledge myself to the working class of Australia that I will not serve as a conscript, and that I will resist by every means in my power any attempt to compel me or any of my comrades in this organisation to break this pledge, even though it may mean imprisonment or death. And I take this pledge voluntarily and freely, knowing that if I break it, I will be branded as a traitor to my class. About 10 times as many people, you know, enlisted to take that pledge than enlisted in that region to join Billy Hughes's army. On October 4 in 1916, there was a one-day general strike against conscription in Victoria. And in the lead-up to the referendum at the end of the month, up to crowds of up to 100,000 gathered in the Domain in Sydney and on the Yarra Banks here in Melbourne to hear anti-conscription orators. And the left scored a stunning victory. That referendum was defeated by around 70,000 votes, much to the surprise of Hughes and the ruling class. Then they tried to have a second referendum, which was defeated by an even bigger majority of 165,000. This was not before, however. Hughes almost brought the federal government to the brink of war with the Queensland government over the issue of conscription. Queensland Labor Premier T.J. Ryan had been pushed into taking a very strong anti-conscription line by unionists in the Labor Party, and also by the socialists who controlled the Brisbane Industrial Council. Hughes had begun to crack down on all forms of the anti-conscription movement, including through censorship. So to get around this, Ryan would read out. The Queensland Premier would read out his anti-conscription speeches in Parliament, so they would enter the parliamentary record, and then they mass-printed copies of Hansard, to get them out to the public. This provoked Hughes to order a military raid on the state printing offices, confiscating 3,300 copies of Hansard. The following day, the Queensland Cabinet met and agreed on a policy which was the following, that, if the military raid the printers again, the executive of the Brisbane Industrial Council were to get about 2,000 tried and trusted unionists to go straight to Parliament House, where the police magistrate would swear them in as special constables. Railway communications were to be severed, the GPO seized so as to get full control of mail, telegraphic and telephonic communications. The other side was planning their war effort as well. Hughes apparently told a friend during these years that he'd authorised the dispatch of some rifles hidden in piano cases and machine guns in big cases marked furniture to be sent to trusted loyalists in Brisbane, to prepare for eventualities. And those eventualities never actually occurred, but it does give you a sense that the divisions in Australian society over this question ran pretty deep. As I said, the war really brought to the fore the class antagonisms in society. And it was the revolutionary left that really made the running in making these points and linking the question of the war to class issues. And the IWW was one of the groups that really excelled at this, had a very strong anti-war position, and not on some pacifist grounds, but on a class basis. At their height, they had around 2,000 members. Their paper had a circulation at each edition of around 15,000. And one of the things that they proclaimed was, "Let those who own Australia do the fighting. Put the wealthiest in the front ranks, the middle class next, follow those with the politicians, lawyers, sky pilots," which is a euphemism for priests, apparently, "and judges. Answer the declaration of war with a call for a general strike. Don't go to hell in order to give the piratical, plurocratic parasites a bigger slice of heaven." They also liked alliteration. The IWW was one of a number of far-left groups that either emerged or grew rapidly in this period. The Victorian Socialist Party shifted to the left and grew in size and influence. In early 1917, they recruit Adela Pankhurst, and by September, she, along with Jenny Baines, was leading thousands of working-class women food riots on the streets of Melbourne. And by 1917, overwhelmingly, the working class was against conscription, and probably a majority were also now against the war. That sets the scene for the biggest or the most momentous industrial battle in Australia's history, the 1917 General Strike. So it begins on the tram and rail workshops in Sydney, a few thousand skilled workers. It then spreads to the rest of the railways. The coal miners refuse to supply coal for the scab run railways. The wharfies walk off the jog, so they don't want to transport the scab coal. The timber yards and warehouses, they don't want to handle goods moved by scab labour off the docks. It spread actually from New South Wales to Victoria. A whole range of Victorian workplaces were out too. About 100,000 workers participating in total. And as Robert Bollard, the historian, commented, "This is not a solemn or dour movement. Militants marched out of mass meetings singing Solidarity Forever. It was sung too on the daily marches of thousands of people that crammed the streets of Sydney, reaching up to at least 150,000 on the Sundays in late August. In one mass meeting, young militants were reported using a convenient piano to play ragtime tunes to drown out anyone who argued against striking." The right-wing, state and federal governments responded with both state repression and organisation. They recruited, an army of scabs from the bush, from the wealthier suburbs, from the elite universities and private schools. Bigger problem, though, was the strike's leadership. Basically, the workers had gone out on strike without reference to their union officials, who didn't particularly want the strike to happen. But unfortunately, there was no alternative leadership. By this stage, state repression had really taken its toll on the IWW. They were smashed up. And in part, this is unfortunate because their quite ill-conceived response to the threat of state repression actually allowed them to be smashed up far too easily. So there's no alternative leadership, and leadership, therefore, was ceded to the same union officials who didn't want the strike in the first place. They spent most of their time trying to stop the strike from spreading, and they ended it as soon as pretty much the first available opportunity. There was mass dissent to this, angry demonstrations when they called off the strikes, but only a few sections of workers actually stayed out, the coal miners and the wharfies. So this was pretty much a defeat, but while 1917 general strike didn't win, in 1919, you have this massive upsurge of major industrial battles, pretty much centred on the same workers who, had participated in 1917. So a number of battles, mainly led by militants of the radical left, saw big victories for the Siemens Union, the Broken Hill Miners. Other sections like the Queensland meat workers actually went down to defeat. But they'll also go down in Australian Labor history for turning up to work with the word revolution emblazed on their red jerseys. Such was the time. This period that we've just looked at is probably the closest Australia has come to revolution. The next phase, the next period I wanted to look at was, again, another very, very international event. In the 1930s, you have the Great Depression, a big period of international radicalisation. We saw in this period the emergence of the unemployed workers movement, which was a communist-led, union of the unemployed. It engaged in many marches for unemployment benefits. It had to stand up to very vicious police repression. It would do things like go and prevent evictions of working class families, or go and reinstall the working class families in their homes after they'd been evicted. They organised strikes on work for the Dole projects, including the War Memorial here in Melbourne. Thousands joined the Communist Party in this period, and a lot of the people who became trained political militants during the 1930s, during the depths of the Depression, then went on to reform the unions after the Depression ended. The unions were pretty much smashed in Australia at the start of the Depression. It was a lot of the people who became radical during the bleak years of the Depression, who then went on to refound Australia's union movement. As with World War One, World War Two, the immediate aftermath of World War Two rather, saw a renaissance of working class struggle in Australia. I'm not going to go into that much detail about it, about all the various tremendous class battles. One significant battle was the Queensland Rail Strike of 1948, and it was significant because it took place against an ALP government. Queensland Premier Ned Hanlon basically evoked a state of emergency on the railways. The arbitration court at the same time, ordered the workers back to work. So you've got two sets of laws, basically meaning that if you stayed out on strike, there's two ways legally that you could be victimised. Nevertheless, the workers did refuse to go back to work. And after 9 weeks, they were victorious and won big wage rises. That was the death knell for Hanlon's plan to keep Queensland as a low-wages state. Basically, all these sections of workers, meat workers, teachers, clerks, you name it, won big pay rises as a result of that. And this sort of period, this post-war period of struggle, culminates in the 1949 coal miners' strike, in which the Labor Prime Minister, Ben Chifley, sends troops into the mine to break the strike. So this is hardly a picture of a workers' paradise. And the next major phase of international struggle also had a really deep impact on Australian society. And that was the 60s and early 70s. You know, we had an explosive student movement, which is really led by various sections of the far left. In the 1960s, students entered the newly expanding higher education sector, a place where they thought, would be a beacon of, inquiry and free thought and so on. And instead, they found themselves in the stultifying environment of often very under-resourced degree factories. But the thing that most underpinned the student radicalism of that period was the Vietnam War. Australia, relative to its size, probably had one of the biggest anti-war movements anywhere in the world. And the better part of a generation had been told that, they lived in the free world. They lived in the part of the world that stood for freedom and democracy and all things good and proper. And people were repulsed by the very criminal actions of the American state and the Australian state in Vietnam. The destruction of whole villages, carpet bombing, napalm, defoliants, and all the rest of it. So in addition to the student and anti-war movements and the various other social movements, women's liberation movement, the gay liberation movement, and so on, the union movement was also at its peak. You had a record number of days taken on strike, and in 1969, workers had smashed the work choices laws of their day, which were known as the penal powers. These were laws that had existed under the Conservative government, which basically meant that unions could be fined for taking industrial action, kind of similar to today. When the Maoist leader of the Victorian Tramways Union, Clary O'Shea, refused to pay those fines, he was jailed. Around 1 million workers struck in Australia, demanding that Clary O'Shea was released, and he was released. These laws were never used again. And, following this, the number of industrial disputes and strike activity really did mushroom. And all of these things, the growth of the left, the huge student movement, radicalisation, steps forward being made by organised labour, these things which took place in Australia once again took place internationally. I mean, you've only got to think of May 68 in France, with 10 million workers struck, the biggest general strike in world history to that day. The Conservative Prime Minister de Gaulle, fleeing briefly to Germany. And the following year in Italy, you have the Year of May, all those factory occupations, the growth of new revolutionary organisations. We could look to the United States, where you've got the birth of new revolutionary organisations like Students for a Democratic Society, the Black Panthers, and so on. Now, Marx said that the struggle of class against class is not only an economic struggle, but a political one as well. And it was towards the end of this period of radicalisation of the 60s and 70s, that there was a major convergence of both economic and political struggle. One of the great contradictions of capitalism is that, on the one hand, it gives people the promise of democracy while constantly actually violating those democratic principles. So the denial of democratic rights, as we know, can be a trigger or a major factor provoking mass revolt by working people. That's been true from Tiananmen Square to Tahrir Square. And it was with the onset of economic crisis in 1974-75 that the Australian ruling class embarked on its boldest ever assault on its supposed democratic system by sacking the Labor government of Gough Whitlam. Whitlam had come to power in 72 after 23 years of Conservative rule. And the Whitlam government had been willing to some degree to accede to some of the expectations of its working class supporters. At the time, the Australian ruling class was more or less willing to accept some of these changes. Now, they looked to Whitlam as a sort of moderniser. So, free university education was meant to provide Australian capitalism with a better skilled, better educated workforce for the more high-tech version of capitalism that existed. But as soon as the recession hits, all of this largesse goes out, relative largesse goes out the window, pretty much as soon as the boom comes to an end. And just as today, recession means one thing from the boss's point of view, and that's austerity for not for themselves, but for the workers. Whitlam obliged. He did introduce a horror budget, but the attacks on workers could not come thick and fast enough. The ruling class wanted a government that they could really trust to wage a vicious class assault on Australian workers. And Liberal leader Malcolm Fraser certainly fitted the bill. About the second half of 1975, all the newspapers pretty much ran constant editorials demanding that the Labor government resign, even though it had been elected only a year earlier. And they pointed to the fact that unemployment had reached 2% to prove that Labor was unfit to govern. Last week, that creep Michelle Grattan wrote in the Fairfax Press, basically just retyped up, you know, the press release that Tony Abbott wrote and Julia Gillard delivered. There's a press release calling for a tax on welfare recipients, and she argued that this was justified because Australia's wonderful economic situation. Because in her words, most economists agree that the current unemployment rate of 4.9% amounts to full employment. I digress. In October of 1975, the Liberals in the Senate moved to block the money supply, so basically starve the government of the money that it needed to function. Workers responded instantly with very angry mass rallies around the country. And soon the newspapers started changing their editorial line. They were calling for calm. They were suggesting maybe the Liberals ought to just negotiate with the government and so on. All of a sudden, Labor's fortunes in the polls revived as people saw the opposition as sabotaging the democratic system. And members of the Liberal parliamentarians, a couple of them, were very close to actually crossing the floor and letting the money supply pass. When on November 11, the Governor-General, a vice-regal representative of a foreign monarch, sacked the democratically elected Prime Minister and appointed Fraser as MP, sorry, PM. And this was nothing short of a ruling class coup. And millions of workers actually saw it that way. Phil Griffiths estimates that at least 50,000 workers struck immediately on the day that this news came out. The Melbourne rally marched to Government House. It had a standoff with the police. And then marched to the Liberal Party headquarters, where windows were broken and a wild melee broke out with the police and about 1,000 demonstrators. And as a measure of the bitterness that existed in the working class, the Furnishing Trades Union were able to maintain a ban on actually replacing the windows at the Liberal Party headquarters for some months. The Sydney rally also marched to Liberal Party headquarters and then to Trades Hall. An impromptu meeting of these workers passed a resolution calling on the ACTU, the state labour councils and the national unions to call a national day of stoppage against the Fraser coup, leading up to a general strike of all workers 1 week later. This is what workers thought needed to happen. These calls for a general strike against the Kerr coup were so widespread that the official historian of the ACTU said that it was the dominant issue that confronted the ACTU leadership when it met with Whitlam on the evening of the coup, this call for a general strike. The army was put on grey alert, and this was, however, an opportunity for Bob Hawke, future Australian Prime Minister, and then ACTU President, to prove his loyalty to Australian capitalism. According to his biographer, Hawke was in dire fear that the emotional reaction to the government sacking could lead to riots. At a press conference, he warned, "A lot of people will want to move for a general strike, but I'm asking them not to. I'm aware that what has happened could unleash forces in Australia which we've never seen before. We are on the edge of something terrible happening. Only the conscription campaign in World War I can compare to the developments today. We don't want to substitute violence in the streets for democracy."
No.
Democracy? Sadly, Whitlam and Hawke did get their way and were able to wind back the struggle. There were, you know, various protest actions and strikes in spite of the inertia from the officials. What all of this raises is the very important role of revolutionary political leadership. Because while there have been clearly times in which a revolution in Australia seemed possible, the question remains, why have there actually not been, out of these moments, a revolutionary challenge to the state? We need to understand that what we're up against in Australia, in a country like Australia, if we want a revolution, we need to understand those things. The ruling class has many things protecting it. In ordinary times, they can rely on the fact that, you know, workers feel subordinated, they don't feel like they can change the world, all of these sorts of things. However, all of this history shows that that doesn't last forever. The periods of mass struggle will erupt, and workers will start feeling confident to challenge the powers that be. And in those times, they can't rely on workers' apathy. They have to rely on other things. So there is, of course, the power of the state. That's obviously an issue that needs to be confronted in a revolutionary situation. But a much more important thing that defends the ruling class and their system is the fact that traditionally the labour movement is run by political forces who are loyal to capitalism. In all of the advanced capitalist countries, you have parties and leaders of this nature. We're talking about the leaders of the would-be reformist organisations like the ALP and its equivalents. And more importantly, the trade union bureaucracy, which seeks to negotiate between capital and labour rather than abolish the system whereby capital exploits labour. So building a revolutionary alternative to this is crucial. And that was what was missing, for instance, in 1975. You know, Hawke, the ACTU leadership, Whitlam and so on, were determined to ensure that the sacking of the government remained a fact. And so what they urged the militant working class to do was simply to donate some of their pay to the ALP's election fund, which wasn't particularly effective. So the problem that we learn from Australian history is not that it's not that nothing ever happens here. That's not the case. It's not that Australian workers can never be militant or can never be radicalised. The problem is that the dominant forces in the working class movement have been against revolution. So the challenge is to build an organisation with the experience, the politics, and the durability to provide leadership when opportunities for revolutionary action emerges. And what we also see from history is, in all of these times of great crisis and great struggle, revolutionary ideas and revolutionary organisations can gain a mass following. In all of the episodes we've looked at, the left grew in these periods. Now, thinking about the future, we obviously don't know under which circumstances radical mass struggle will re-emerge in this country. The Australian economy has thus far been sheltered from the worst of the global economic crisis. This is due to the high demand and high prices for mineral exports, particularly to China. But Australian prosperity is pretty thinly based. For one thing, not everyone is prospering. Household debt is at record levels. Welfare recipients, particularly the disabled, are about to be savagely attacked in the upcoming budget. The thing is that people might not like Abbott and Gillard. They might have all sorts of gripes against their boss. They might not like the fact that, you know, just as likely as not, their job today is casualised, all of these sorts of things. But for the time being, this is not leading to an explosion of mass struggle. Economic crisis spreads unevenly across the globe. Some countries are more deeply affected than others and more rapidly affected than others. But eventually, every country experiences the crises of capitalism. With the mineral sector being so incredibly profitable at the moment globally, there's actually been record levels of new investments in the sector, you know, throughout Africa, throughout Latin America, and so on. And there's a long lead-in time for these investments, you know, these new mines to become productive. But when they do, it's quite possible that, you know, there could be overproduction, there could be real slackening in the prices for these minerals, the super profits can begin to disappear. And that could particularly be the case if demand from China begins to slacken as well, if the economic growth in China begins to decelerate. So Australia's economic future cannot remain rosy forever. We should remember that even without this crisis situation, there's a new round of government cutbacks just about to be unleashed. There's no budget crisis, there's no economic troubles, and yet they're going after us. And you can only imagine, therefore, that if the economy does tank, just imagine the kind of severe austerity measures that we would likely receive from either the Labor Party or the Liberal Party. In that context, mass political consciousness would be seriously transformed. If your average worker today is a bit, you know, demoralised, dispassionate about politics, maybe a bit complacent. In the context of economic crisis and austerity, workers and students can no longer afford to be complacent. A whole new audience can open up for radical ideas as the system seems to no longer meet the basic needs of people. No longer meet people's expectations. New mass struggles can emerge. People can get an experience of mass struggle. New traditions of struggle and of radicalism can be forged. And we must remember that Australian politics is not some bubble separated off from the rest of the world. If mass struggle reemerges in this country in the not too distant future, it will actually be taking place in a context of international revolution. Now, unsurprisingly, the first great revolutions of the 21st century did not begin in Australia. They happen to begin in the Arab world. But we are quite possibly at the very early stages of a revival of revolution on this planet. And should the revolutionary spirit spread and take effect beyond the Middle East and the Arab world, should it spread to the European world or to our very important trading partner of China, then the whole concept of revolution will more and more be a frame of reference for Australian workers in their struggles in the future. And then the battle to win masses of Australian workers to the idea of a red Australia can begin.